Hi, I'm Caroline, a yoga teacher with a special interest in menopause based in Edinburgh.
And hi, I'm Dr. Claire, a GP with a special interest in menopause based in North London.
Together, we are the Menopause Sisters, and we're here to guide and support you through your menopause journey. Welcome to the Menopause Sisters show, and we're really pleased to have Dr. Angela Wright with us today. She is an experienced GP and clinical sexologist with a special interest in women's health, and she's also a British Menopause Society accredited advanced menopause specialist, just like Dr. Claire, and consults at an NHS menopause clinic in Hull, focusing on menopause, PMDD, and sexual dysfunction. So, gosh, a lot of expertise in this room today. Really welcome, Angela. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Can we maybe just begin with why you went in this direction? You know, where at what point did you decide you wanted to go in this direction?
I mean, I'd like to have a really good reason for doing it, but it was one of those. I was a part-time GP. I'd been working in hospice medicine for, you know, 10 years or so, and looking to add another string to my bow. And I really just went down the route of looking at various courses that were available, and the syllabus for the course that I did in clinical sexology just hooked me from the beginning, because it was all about, you know, the forensics, relationships, sexual trauma. Just a lot of stuff that I think we touch on and go into as GPs, but get really little training on. So I did that purely for interest, and then added on the sexual medicine training on the back of it, because I felt I needed more kind of medicine to underpin it than just the therapeutic training. And then started using it at work with women who are going through menopause. So the menopause bit was the last thing that I added on. I did the BMS training last, really.
It's interesting, this kind of connection as well, as you were just saying, with menopause there, you know, sort of linking it in quite quickly to that, because we know so many women struggle with so many symptoms around, you know, the vaginal dryness, the loss of libido, and actually just being able to have that extra expertise must be incredibly helpful in supporting women.
Yeah, I mean, I've just been consulting this morning, and I think it's, I often talk to women and say, because I was trained in what's called a biopsychosocial model. So we tend to go in as menopause specialists, kind of, there's lots of biological stuff happening, isn't there? So it's quite easy to say, well, I know you're going to need more vaginal estrogen, you're going to need lubrication, you might need testosterone. But actually, I think there's quite a lot of psychological stuff that happens fairly predictably around that age that we go through menopause, around that transition, that change in identity. There's a lot of relational stuff that happens at the same time. I think people's trauma, we're talking about trauma today, but I think it comes up quite a lot for them at this point as well, and overlaps with all the vasomotor symptoms. So just think, in all those areas, sexuality has, you know, it can change, and it's really helpful. And I get asked a lot about it, because you do the bits that are biological, the bits that are hormone related, but it doesn't always fix everything. And then it's what do you do with women where there's still a problem?
Yeah, and that's exactly how we connected, wasn't it? It was actually Rebecca Wicks, who's a pharmacist based up here in Scotland, and she'd said, I think you've got to meet Angela. She said she's kind of hooked us up via LinkedIn, actually, because I think she'd be really interesting to talk to. And because of my trauma-informed work and your trauma-informed work, that's how we actually connected. And as you mentioned, you know, many women have experienced a sexual trauma. So, you know, how does that play out? Or it doesn't have to be sexual trauma, any trauma within their lives and the history of their lifetime. How does that play out in menopause? I know there is two or three very small studies out of the States that suggest that symptoms are worse through perimenopause and menopause if you have experienced a trauma. But I wondered what your experience was, just from, you know, from seeing patients.
Yeah, just clinically. I mean, that's what you instinctively feel, isn't it? I think it's because that same kind of final common pathway that we feel our sort of anxiety through, that, you know, the palpitations, the feeling sweaty, the feeling on edge. I think that's got huge crossover with PTSD symptoms. And so I think, like you, I've seen the same small studies that have come out. We started collecting data locally. I'm involved in I'm a director for a local trauma centre, and we've got a database of 3,000 women that are signed up. So we've been collecting some data on those women, just about what happened to their PTSD symptoms as they entered perimenopause. And lots of them are reporting that they intensified. And again, I think it's that sort of biological state that we get into allows those symptoms to feel like they're intensifying. But also, we talked about it, didn't we, this sort of mind-body connection, that when your body feels anxious, your mind starts to feel anxious. And I think it just gets into a bit of a vicious cycle. And it's a big identity change. So whenever we change our identity, we kind of work out who we are, where we've come from. So I think a lot of these themes come up for people around this time.
Yeah, and I was quite interested as another GP, I'm quite interested in that kind of biopsychosocial model and how we often say holistic approach, don't we? But do we really mean it? And I wondered if you could just explain a bit about what that might mean and how that might look for some of our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, because we're trained, or certainly I was trained, and probably you've been trained in a more biomedical model. And I think historically in medicine, we have a set of notes that are psychiatric notes, we have a set of notes that are medical notes, we even have different buildings and wards for people, because we put this false distinction between what's happened to us and, you know, and our physical health. To do the qualification that I did, I had to do 50 sessions of personal therapy. So as well as doing the learning, I was kind of experiencing what it's like to go through and sift through my sort of previous stuff that comes up for me. And it's just changed enormously how I approach consulting with patients. It's actually made it quite difficult in GP and NHS, because there's all these little boxes and rabbit holes that I want to go down, and I just consult slowly and tend to run late. But I think it's understanding that you cannot separate the three things from each other, that your physical health intrinsically impacts your psychological health and vice versa. And we live in systems and relationships and cultural settings that influence our access to healthcare, our knowledge about ourselves, you know, the kind of personal power that we feel we've got within relationships, how we consider that we might change, you know, it making changes with health and relationships and things. So how it plays out, I mean, how I try to make it play out is that I try to ask people a bit about that context that I'm seeing them in. So I'll explore about, I'll often just sort of put it out there in a, you know, are there any relevant things happening in your life? I'll often ask about whether there's any historic traumas and whether that feels like it's having an influence at the moment. But I think therapists are often really careful that if they unpack boxes, they know they're going to be able to safely help people hold it and pack it in again. Maybe that's more difficult for us in general practice. We see them over a long period, but I'm kind of mindful about being careful how I sort of go through that stuff with patients.
Yeah, and particularly when we're talking about, in this case, maybe sexual trauma and that transition of the perimenopause, that's quite a difficult path to navigate sometimes, isn't it? Because you do need to have the correct language and use the correct words and also take the correct cues from whoever's sitting in front of you to manage that. And I wondered, is that something that we can all approach differently? How would you suggest that that's approached, you know, in that initial perhaps first consultation, or is that something that just develops over time and with the rapport that you might build up with a client?
I don't know. I think it's important that you're always aware and open to the fact that there may be some backstory that you're not aware of. And I suppose we all instinctively know that anyway. And I was taught when I was doing the sort of the therapeutic part of my training that really it's just about curiosity. It's about asking why and having that. And I think I do that naturally, and probably you guys do that naturally anyway. I think people that end up in this kind of work, you're kind of curious about what's happening and why. But I think there are things that we do that can potentially be jarring for patients that we're not trained to think about. Certainly in the medical training that I had, I didn't get very much training about trauma and how what's happened to people might impact them. So I didn't, I would like to think I was always a respectful person examining patients, but I didn't explicitly go into examinations trying to put the patient in control of that process and giving them explicit, you know, consent to stop it at any point if they didn't want to continue. And I think my training has made me much more conscious of my ability to accidentally re-traumatize people or make them feel vulnerable in intimate examinations, so much so that I got involved in just doing a little bit of video work actually for a campaign being done by the Survivors Trust called Check With Me First. And it's just the idea that we truly need to do something as simple as that if we're going to examine somebody, ask if they find those kind of examinations difficult, ask if we can do something to make it easier, and make sure that they know that they can stop it. And I think that's probably something that I keep trying to put into other things that I'm involved with now, because I'm kind of shocked that that was never made plain to me before I started. And I'd never really, you know, never really thought about how difficult it is for lots of our patients when we cross those boundaries.
And I think, you know, as a medical student, certainly as a GP trainee, we're always taught about, you know, offer the chaperone. Yeah. But actually it's more than just offering the chaperone, isn't it? It's about telling our GP trainees and teaching them that actually asking consent and saying stop, and it's that's okay.
It's a handing over of power, isn't it? Something about the dynamic in a consultation. And I think it's probably getting more equal over time. Our patients are much better at challenging us and asking us questions and holding their space. But people who haven't had a good experience of doing that in the past are probably going to find that even harder. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to be mindful of making it explicit who's in control. And actually, the person who should be in control of any examination should be the person whose body it is. Mm-hmm. So, and I was exactly the same as you. I was taught about consent. I was taught to be, you know, to be respectful and to be observant and to do all the kind of good practice that we take for granted. But I still think it's really helpful to be explicit about handing that over, because one trauma response is to freeze and to go nonverbal. So your really quiet patient who looks like they're complying with an examination and is fine might be being re-traumatized, and we need to be mindful of that.
It's interesting because, you know, everything we're discussing here, it relates to a trauma-informed approach, regardless of what you might be doing, you know, handing power over and making sure the person that you're working with or helping or supporting has that agency, and giving them a voice. With the trauma-informed yoga approach, it's very, very similar. And it's, you know, it's about anything from how we dress and guide a class, making sure we're fully covered, to the language you use and using that invitational language and making sure they have the language or the hand signals they need to stop or change anything they need to. So it's a fascinating conversation, because I know the Scottish Government have got a national trauma training program, and I think it might have got halted at some point because of COVID, and I'm not sure how far along they are with that. But that's, you know, that's their goal and their plan, to ensure the workforce is trauma-informed or trauma-aware. And as you say, Angela, it pervades everything. You know, we've all possibly experienced a trauma, whether that's, you know, a death of a parent or a loved one, to just anything that has changed the way we live, you know, has adversely affected us.
I have a friend who went through the bereavement of her eldest son, and she got frustrated having to spell out that there was something relevant recently in her life that was affecting her experience of things. And I think it is about that shift, so that we always try and put our patient in context. We always try and find out what's been going on for them recently, whether there's been any major events. And yeah, absolutely, that not all trauma is going to be sexual trauma, but it's all going to have its impact on how we experience our health.
We're not going to get it right all of the time. You know, I think there's that element as well of that understanding, but looking at the bias and the lenses sometimes we have, perhaps, and I'm picking those from our personal experiences as well, isn't it? There's a lot of work around this whole trauma-informed and trauma-aware approach to be done.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What I really enjoyed hearing from you earlier, Andrew, is just, you know, that idea that we separate our hospitals out into psychiatric and into, you know, and that. And of course, you sort of know that in the back of your mind, but it's really interesting, isn't it? Because we do the same with ourselves, and actually we separate patients' problems out, and we have a distinct kind of line, don't we? One specialty, we only deal with one thing. And as a GP, we're sort of trying to be a bit more biopsychosocial in a way. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's really important to remember that we aren't just libido. Our libido is not just about kind of hormones. It's multifactorial, isn't it? There's lots of issues around libido. It's not just going to be about testosterone or HRT. Mm. But equally, you know, there's going to be a lot of other things that affect that, aren't there? And remembering that, and I guess talking about it, it's easy to think about, but it's when you're in that situation, it's really important to be able to remember that, you know, that awful day at work is going to have a negative impact on you, or that bad night's sleep is going to have a negative. And it's just getting our heads around the fact that it's not just X plus Y equals Z, for example. You know, it's just there's lots of other things going on.
Yeah, I think the power of, so I think dissociation and distraction are really important when it comes to sexuality. And, you know, I do quite a lot of work with Maggies and women that have had cancer. And part of that is the induced menopause stuff. And part of that is trying to give them space to talk about sexuality. And, you know, think about when you, I don't know about anybody else, but if I give blood or if I have a blood test taken, I will look away from my arm so that I don't feel it quite so acutely. So if you're going through the kind of treatments that we put people through in the process of treating cancer, you learn over and over again to come out of your body to cope with the really miserable symptoms that you've got. So when it comes to sexuality after something like that, you've actually got to make the body a safe space to re-enter again. And I think that's a really good sort of parallel when we're talking about other forms of trauma, that sort of ability to be inside our body during sex. And we get that even with just the distractions of the average menopausal woman's life when they're juggling, you know, aging parents, children, work that's really busy, their body's doing different things. And you can easily be up in your brain and giving your focus to what you're thinking rather than to what you're feeling. So I do like using testosterone. I probably use it more than the average menopause doctor might do because I'm doing lots of sexual function work. Mm-hmm. And I look at it as, you know, if you don't have your hormones right, it's like trying to drive your car with the handbrake on. So you want to get that base layer sorted. But I'm less impressed by the impact of testosterone than I think patients sometimes believe it's going to be really, really good. And actually in practice, when I start unpicking what's going on with someone's sexual functional libido, it's often one jigsaw piece in, you know, much bigger picture.
And I think, you know, it's important to remember that because, yes, for some women, hormones will be really, really brilliant, but it's a base layer, isn't it? You've got other things you need to build on top of that.
Talked about it before, haven't we? Particularly because the second documentary that came out a few months ago now, isn't it, or 3 weeks ago, you know, there was a big push for testosterone, and it's not easily available, I should say, through your GP and through the NHS, and I think there was a bit of an upsurge in patients asking for testosterone. But, you know, we pointed out, and as you're saying, Angela, you know, it might not be this golden nugget, this golden bullet, and so much else tied up with libido and sex with a partner around this stage, of particularly menopause as well.
And wellness. And, you know, all of it is, you know, because libido is good old Esther Perel, who's one of the relationship therapists that I love in this space. And, you know, she's always saying that libido is really zest for life. It's not just about sex. It's your get up and go for everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, testosterone is kind of fundamental for people's energy and their get up and go. And I would never want to, you know, I use it as a baseline in most people, but there's so many other things that we need to layer on top of that, not least women giving themselves, not trying to be too gendered about it, but that sort of permission for pleasure, just all pleasure, you know, to eat things that they enjoy, to drink things that they enjoy, to sit down and do nothing and just be lazy for 20 minutes, you know, that's out of reach of a lot of us, isn't it? So
yeah, exactly.
No wonder pleasure is out of reach for, yeah, exactly.
It's absolutely fascinating because Carol and I have spoken about this before, and actually allowing yourself to do nothing is a really big gift, but we don't allow ourselves to do that because we always got to be doing the next thing. But yeah, I think it's really interesting how for many years, as and again, not to be too gender specific, but I'm going to use the word women, but women have allowed themselves not to have that enjoyment and to be just acceptant that things will change and maybe change negatively for them around the perimenopause and menopause. And it doesn't always have to be that way. We're very focused on making menopause a positive transition, but, you know, our lives don't actually stay the same. You know, you're coming to terms with perhaps a loss of fertility, or, you know, changes within your relationship, or like you said, Angela, juggling kids, juggling work. And that's, I think, acceptance of that is also really important.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a book that I read when I was starting to do my psychology. It's really old psychology training, and it's called Passages. And it's just written about life stages. And effectively what it says is that your 40s are about as psychologically challenging as your teens are, because you know, you're doing different things at different stages, but by the time you're into your 40s, and I'm again recognizing that not everybody's menopause takes place in that decade, but you're at the point where you've realized that life is definitely finite, that you are quite a good way into this journey that you're on. And it puts a bit of pressure on if things aren't okay, if you haven't achieved, you know, the relationship that you wanted to be in, or the fertility aims that you may have had around having children, or the work things, or. And I think that that pressure is often an underlying part of why it's difficult, this transition. You haven't got forever to fix it anymore. And some of the doors feel more closed than they did a decade ago. So I think all of that's quite a psychologically challenging time. And actually, if you, like a lot of psychological challenges, if you can process it properly, actually you can come out of it in a much more positive place. But it's helping people to do that. And I don't think culturally we're very good still at handholding and helping people through those sort of transitions.
It's relieving those extra pressures. And we realise for many, it's just not possible. You know, it's, you know, taking those 5 minutes for a cup of tea, or that 10 minute for a walk, or those 20 minutes to have a call with someone, a good friend. It can be a huge luxury for so many people. And if we're starting at that base level of self-care and a little bit of time for yourself, you know, in that process of reaching and thinking about libido, that's quite a big ask for many people, isn't it?
There was, when I first started training, in fact, you know, there's a couple of things that really hooked me into sexology. And one of them was, it's a lady who's recently died called Ellen Lahn, and she did a manifesto for the clitoris as a lecture, which was just a brilliant lecture. But one of the things she was saying was that even in young women between 16 and 35, she quoted that a third of them regularly experience pain with sex. But what I found really interesting was, is they continue to have sex. So already you're kind of this tolerance that women have around putting up with unpleasant things, being stoical, someone else's pleasure maybe being more important than ours, that's already there in young women. And then the other thing that she talked about was that people that struggle to climax, often there's a study where they said they often struggle to name other pleasurable physical sensations, anything, because they're so dissociated from their bodies often. And I think lots of women with our enormous to-do list, the to-do list at the start of Caitlin Moran's book that she did brilliantly, with this massive list that we're all holding in our heads. I've got one on my phone, which is ridiculous. And life is a constant, you know, you're constantly ticking that stuff off. You're holding the emotional load of everybody around you, half your friends, you know, all of our patients and clients. So you do come at the bottom of that list. And it's no, I don't think it's a great shock that we find this transition knocks us sideways and it hits sexuality in such a big way. We have to sort of change something about how we're allowed to prioritize our own needs. It really, it's kind of cliched, but it's incredibly true that doing literally nothing, I still struggle with that. I still have to say that it's exercise, or I'm going for a walk, or, you know, it's active mindfulness to sit on the sofa and do nothing.
Active mindfulness, that's great, Angela. Yeah, and actually I work with a lot of long COVID patients now as well. And, you know, that I have to go through, and, you know, we say, you know, even scrolling through social media, you're doing something that is not resting, you know. Yeah. So actually really stopping, and I like the idea of active mindfulness. I love a walk, you know, that for me, but trying not to then listen to a podcast and trying not to make a phone call, just walking and being quiet is, I think, quite a challenge in itself, because we are so used to doing, you know, it's all do, and what are we achieving? So, yeah. But coming back to sex and pleasure at this stage in our lives, what are the first things that we potentially could be looking at?
So I have been taught loads of different ways of looking at this, but the one that I find is the problem I have is I was taught to be a therapist, which means that you're taught around doing 50 minute sessions, at least 10 of them. And I got all those lovely skills, and I came back into my NHS day job and went, what am I going to do with this in this setting? So what I end up doing with patients a lot is directing them to resources and things that I think are helpful. And Karen Gurney, the sex doctor, is brilliant as in terms of a resource. I love her idea of a triangle, and I use that quite a lot with patients, this idea of the triangle of good enough sex or good sexuality. And that is just getting your patients to think about when physical arousal is at its peak. And that's work for us in menopause, isn't it? About making sure that they're well estrogenized, if they've got the right hormones going in systemically. you know, with my medical sexology hat on, it's going through the rest of the meds list and making sure they're not on things that dampen it down, because there's loads of those things. And then there's the kind of, I think, did I say this is physical arousal? I may have said psychological arousal, but this is all physical arousal. There's the psychological arousal, which is all your erotic palate stuff. And it's making sure that the context, the partner, the stuff you're doing, all of that is really a turn on for you. And you can get typecast in long-term relationships. It can be difficult to change sexually. And actually, we're all somewhat bigger than the shared sexuality we have with a partner. So sometimes it's about kind of renegotiating what's in that shared space. And the bottom bit, which I think is the sort of most important thing that I talk about with patients, is this idea of your mental presence in sex. And just what you were saying about the walking, I often start with patients in terms of self-focus, sensate focus stuff, way outside anything that's sexual, and just telling them to go for a walk and to notice what they can smell and notice the feel of the ground around them and what they can see, just to focus on their sensory input, because it's a lens that we don't have in our daily lives. We're buzzing about like crazy, only really noticing the really offensive sensory input. Like we were just talking about how hot the tube was on the way home for Claire, and you notice that because it's unpleasant, but we're not brilliant at tuning in on the nice stuff, you know, slowing down and eating and going, oh, that's the texture, the flavor. So I think it's something about a sort of a pleasure principle and defining your sexuality around you. I think, again, not to be too gendered, but I think culturally, historically, many of us consider ourselves as partners more than we consider ourselves with our sexuality and what we want at the center. And sometimes there's work to be done around that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's just clear, isn't it? The more we talk about it, the more you realize how much there is to take into consideration, not just as doctors or yoga teachers, but just as you know, individual women ourselves. And what we need to start to think about is, I guess, feeling less awkward talking about sex, maybe. You know, maybe just normalizing it a bit, sort of how the perimenopause and menopause is being talked about a bit more without that taboo attached quite so much. I know it's still a work in progress, but perhaps that's something that we need to become sort of more comfortable in raising, and perhaps raising with our doctors. I guess the issue I have with that, having said that, is, you know, you want the response from your health professional to be judged, don't you, in the correct way. And that's if particularly if we're talking about sexual trauma or trauma in general, that can be overwhelming. I think that can be a worry to even bring that to the conversation, to bring it to the table.
And I think as well, even though there is correlation obviously between people that have experienced sexual trauma and the prevalence of problems with sex, one doesn't equal the other. And there are lots of people who don't want to go back to something that's happened and consider that it's still having an impact, and it may not still be having an impact as well. So I think, like a lot of things with sex, you know, I was at the BSSM on Friday and talking about raising sexuality with patients after cancer, but it's also making sure that it's not a pressure. One of the things that I think can get leveled at the menopause campaign at the moment is the fact that some people do want to just, you know, shove a cardigan on and not have to try hard after a certain point. And actually, if we're all still having to be running, jumping, climbing trees, looking hot and having great sex, that's a pressure for some people. So it's defining it around what you want and binning all these kind of cultural definitions or these societal definitions of what you should be. Should is not very helpful. It's about what do I want?
No, and I was thinking about some of the celebrities that have been campaigning for menopause, and it's wonderful because they've got a voice and they're using it. But actually, yeah. I know for many people, just looking at that celebrity, whichever celebrity they quite like, you know, there's many of them campaigning around it and doing some great work. But actually, when you don't look like that person, and you're like, well, they're going through menopause and they look like that, possibly a size 8 or 10, and you know, obviously have a lot more money perhaps than some of us, and can afford various treatments and lovely clothes, then actually that in itself is an added pressure. And just as you were saying, Angela, actually it's okay to be where you're at right now. It's there's a level of acceptance, but also a lot of self-care and forgiveness of yourself, I think, and but also gratitude, that idea of saying thank you to yourself for giving yourself those 5 minutes, those 10 minutes, whatever it might be, and just, you know, mentally saying, I needed that. I'm really glad I took it. And I'm going to thank myself and perhaps somebody who's helped you facilitate it as well.
It's also the language we use. I think you're right about the celebrities that we're seeing fronting this up. They look brilliant for their age, you know, in a way that may or may not be in reach for those of us that can't access some of the things that they're doing. And a lot of the women that I speak to talk about self-esteem, and they struggle to find themselves sexy. And if you don't find yourself desirable, it's quite difficult to put yourself into a situation where, you know, where you're supposed to be feeling sexual. So I do think that we can actively work on our language, and we can actively work on the stream that we allow into our consciousness, you know, filtering your social media. I hate how Instagram keeps showing me women in bikinis, because I don't really care about women in bikinis, and it doesn't help me feel good. And, you know, I think these are like microaggressions all the time, telling you that here's a standard and this is the gap between you and the standard. Yeah. So you have to, I think you have to be mindful about what you allow in, about the lens that you put on it, what, you know, why those images are there and what they're trying to do. And using language about your body that is positive and not always appearance based. That's why I like strength training and some of the things in like yoga and so on, because we keep trying to be less as women, to lose weight, burn calories, shrink clothes sizes. Sometimes doing an exercise that's built around gaining muscle strength, ability to do yoga poses, that stuff helps you to genuinely appreciate your body.
Yeah. And I teach a lot around the breath, and just that simple idea of breathing well can, it helps psychologically calm the mind. It helps physically, because we know if we breathe well, you're supporting all the body systems and reducing stress, you know, cortisol and adrenaline. And we know that's all connected again with, you know, with trauma. And so actually there's all these little things we can do, but I think it's very interesting what you're saying about turning off certain social media feeds as well. I did that a few years ago and that was joyful, actually, just going, why am I looking at this person?
Mine changed at 40. I literally went overnight. Facebook started to show me things about thinning hair and, you know, clothes for mature women and face creams that I might need. And I thought, I didn't get this at 39 and 365 days. Yeah. I kind of went through and just, I told them I liked gardening, because you can actually change your preferences. So I just told them I like a whole bunch of different things and changed my feed.
Brilliant.
It helps.
Love that. I might have to do the same. Gardening and, I don't know, yeah.
Rituals.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip, because nothing's better.
The station that makes you feel good.
I mean, I guess what I wanted to also spend a moment focusing on is, obviously I said earlier, you know, it's not all about HRT and testosterone, but obviously we are talking about the perimenopause and menopause, and it is something that we should mention, that it can be really helpful, can't it? Because we're talking about, specifically, let's talk about topical vaginal estrogens. And if you're having painful sex, actually what's going to help make that better is some vaginal estrogen, isn't it? And we know that's very, very safe.
Yeah, and I don't know what your practice is, Claire, but I also make a big fuss about using it externally as well as internally. I find it fascinating, again, with my sexology hat on, that all of the guidance pretty much is to estrogenize to allow penetration, and it's not really about to estrogenize to allow pleasure. So, I'm a member of the BSSM, and they did some guidance last year before I joined them, actually. But the BSSM consensus statement on genitourinary syndrome of menopause is like the nicest document, because it gives you a really good evidence base for using estrogen in both places, inside and outside, in higher doses than the licensed dose, because I think the licensed doses are a bit low for most women, and using it in women who've had cancer history, hormone sensitive cancer history. And we see loads of those in places like Maggie's that have never been told that that's an option for them, you know. And it's not just sex. I had a lady the other day who'd stopped riding horses, which she loved doing because of the discomfort that she had in the vulva. So I have very proactive conversations with my patients, even if they don't come to me saying that they've got these issues. I will tell them this might be on the horizon, and sexual function might change. And if you notice any change in arousal or ability to climax or lubrication, to get in early, because after a point you start losing structure, you know, and you have those nighttime clitoral erections that you don't know you're getting, and that's all to do with the blood flow and everything else, and all of that quietly stops or reduces as you get older. And if we don't warn women about it, that, you know, they have to wait for those problems to be there, and then all the psychological stuff piles on the back of, I can't climax anymore, or, oh my goodness, I don't, he's going to think I'm not interested because I'm not getting aroused. And then that makes it really complicated. So getting in early is helpful.
I always put my hand up and say I'm taking vaginal estrogen, and it's made a huge difference. But actually, I was at a workshop 2 weeks ago, some trauma-informed work actually as well, with a group of women, some from a self-harm unit, some from an addiction charity that had been helping them. But we were talking about periods. My colleague was talking about periods, and I was going through menopause. And there's obviously a lot of learning and understanding going on around the cycle. And, you know, when they were feeling down and feeling like they needed a crutch, needed certain things, but also that understanding. And I was there going, yep, vaginal estrogen. And this was suddenly the floodgates opened. Yeah. You know, these women talking about sore vulvas, this kind of soreness or burning. And it was a really positive discussion, because actually, unless we talk about it, it gets brushed under the carpet. And I hope that through our voices talking about it, it enables other women to feel confident about potentially speaking to a healthcare professional.
I think that's another area where it sort of layers on with the trauma again, because if you start to experience discomfort again, some of these things can actually be quite triggering as well. So I think, yeah, I think we aren't taught very much about being proactive. We're not taught about using estrogens in non-menopausal women, actually, the breastfeeding women and the women that are on, you know, things that would feel counterintuitive, but birth control pills can make you get vaginal soreness and dryness. And I was a women's health doctor and I hadn't really been trained in that stuff. So if we don't know it as health professionals, then I do think the access that patients get must be quite patchy. And there's definitely a lot of work to be done in letting them be aware of what their options are at all different stages.
So we often do suggest that you speak to the nurse at your GP practice to begin with, because they are potentially, you know, a good first point of call, and having that understanding, as they do tend to be the practitioners that do the smear tests, obviously. Yes. And you can have that conversation initially with them if this is something that concerns you, but also around HRT and menopause as well.
Yeah, my nurse to send me lots of patients now of all ages, because they'll pick up the ladies that have got vaginismus, so that kind of pelvic floor muscle contraction, when they come for a smear test. So I do get quite a feed of patients to me of all ages, because we've picked up that they're struggling with swabs being done or smear being done. Oh, is sex painful? Okay, you can talk to Dr. Wright. And I think before I did sexology, obviously I didn't see any of these patients. So it just makes you think how many in everyone's practice, they're there under the radar, not being seen.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, actually, because as soon as you start to specialise in something a bit more, you start to see that, like Caroline said, a bit like the floodgates opening, because it's suddenly kind of giving people, it's allowing women to talk about their symptoms. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I think that's a really interesting point, that, you know, practice nurses can be picking up on these symptoms, particularly with vaginismus, with swabs. I think the problem there is obviously more and more of the time, actually what we're doing is self-taken swabs. So women aren't necessarily seeing anybody for those vulval examinations. And every 3 to 5 years, they're having their smear. But, you know, all that time in between, they're not actually seeing anybody. So I think it's really important we know our own bodies. There's a lot of specialists out there, and actually if you're not comfortable seeing one particular health professional within your practice, just ask to see someone else, and, you know, find out who you're comfortable with, and just see them a few times and build up that rapport before you have that clinical examination, because there will be somebody, I think, that perhaps you feel more comfortable with,
And again, it's about feeling comfortable having that examination and, you know, having that rapport with your clinician, really.
I think they're the barriers, aren't they? So I think that's back, sort of circling back to the bit around the reluctance to be examined or the potentially re-triggering nature of being examined. It's another barrier that's been put up. So I think if patients got used to the fact that it's much more usual to be asked and given explicit consent in those in those situations with an examination, I think that would help. But I agree with you, Claire. I tend to rant about the fact that I've got a 13-year-old daughter, and I think that the time that women need to receive information about all of these things to do with their reproductive health is as they go into their reproductive years. So I personally believe we should be expanding what we teach beyond not getting pregnant and you know, not getting an STI from sex, but actually what to do if you have difficult bleeding with your periods, what to do if you get mood change, like how much under the radar PMDD, PMS, these sort of mood disorders that people experience that they don't recognize for years and years because no one's let them understand that, you know, you can track this stuff. And in sexual pain, I think if we just equip people with, and similar training, education for boys, if we could equip the patients with the understanding of what might be wrong with them, it would create the demand that would then make sure that the practitioners actually needed to provide those services. I think it's quite hard to retrofit training on a bunch of doctors that have been working for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got lots of areas. Where do we start? But actually, if patients understand, like with menopause, that's what's happened with menopause. They've come up and go, God, I've got all these symptoms. I need practitioners to see. And suddenly we're training a lot more people to try and meet the demands. So I do wonder if we've got it the wrong way around, that we actually have to train patients to know the words and the language.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Angela, actually. You know, it's kind of, I often sort of, you know, it's been cited before, you know, menopause being a second puberty. And actually, if boys and girls are able to know there's something else coming at the other end, then at least there's the knowledge. It doesn't have to be in depth, but, you know, there can be some signposting and just a little bit of information. And I've just bought my three boys a book on periods. They weren't that impressed, I have to say. But I said, you all have to know, because, yeah, you know, regardless of you being boys at this moment, you are living with me and you are likely to have to work with and deal with women. So that understanding is important. Yeah, so important.
And they take it as they, you know, I don't think that children are naturally embarrassed about that stuff unless we pass that to them. I did all of my revision for my membership exams for sexual medicine, you know, over a Christmas period with kids coming up behind me and looking at what I was doing. And you just have age-appropriate conversations around it. You know, our house is a bit more complicated in that my son tried to explain when he was younger what I did for a job to his grammar school tutors and said I was a sex worker. So I had to get him to seriously backtrack in his explanation of what I did.
That's a brilliant story.
Yeah. Didn't feel so great at parents even. No. That kind of, they take it as read that it's normal, it's talked about, it's kind of, you know, the doors are open to have those conversations, and it's not weird, actually. It's quite easy.
Yeah, actually, once you start those conversations, and it's okay. We call sexing in our house because our youngest says, oh no, the sexing if we're watching a film together, or he thinks that's sort of thing. Yeah. And we're only watching sort of, you know, age 12 appropriate films because he's nearly 10. But yeah, we just call it sexing. So, you know, that's become our word, and that's fine. It's absolutely, they know exactly what we're talking about. Andrew, we're probably gonna have to wind up, actually, but just wondering if there are any signposting websites you might be able to leave us with, or any tips that you'd like us to leave, you know, like to leave our listeners with as well.
From a getting help with sexual problems point of view, then the best thing I could do is probably signpost you to where the practitioners are. So the COSRT website is the College of Sex and Relationship Therapists website, which is the college that I was trained by. They have a list of practitioners. The IPM is the other approach that we have in medicine, which is a slightly different approach, but that's the Institute for Psychosexual Medicine, and they have a list of practitioners. And then there's people like myself that sort of, you know, bridge both sides and can be referred on the NHS and privately. And then I think in terms of sort of, you know, trauma specific stuff, it really depends on the kind of trauma that you're looking for some support with, really. So it's probably difficult to give a list, but the Survivors Trust do lots of work, and they do lots of signposting to local organizations. So that's a good name to be aware of. And I often, I like what Karen Gurney's done in her Mind the Gap book. So I often recommend my patients start with that book as a decent explanation of female sexuality. Really, I when I teach about this stuff and teach doctors on this stuff, I say that actually all we need to do as practitioners is open the conversation. We don't need the solutions to it. We just need to let people know it's okay to talk about. And I think that's what puts people off opening the boxes, actually, in terms of in general practices. Well, how on earth am I going to, what am I going to do with it? Mm-hmm. But if we do that, then we kind of collude with the fact that it's somehow shameful or we shouldn't open it up. So actually, I think the biggest tip I would have is that raise it and be aware that your practitioner is probably going to be very happy that you've raised it, and vice versa for health practitioners.
It becomes a joint conversation then, because if it is raised, then, you know, I think a lot of practitioners are really honest and say, well, actually, I'm not sure where to signpost you, and I'll come back to you with that, how I can help you.
Amazing.
Thank you so much, Angela, for taking your afternoon to speak to us today. Really lovely to connect, and I know our paths will cross again.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.